This past summer, Spokane's daily newspaper, the Spokesman Review, started doing something a little different. Every Sunday, a few sections in, it published a short story. Not a news story, a fictional story. These were by local novelists and short story writers, and they were all about going to the fair. Some were about the 1974 World's Fair in Spokane, which is having an anniversary. Others, the usual fairs that punctuate the end of every summer. And now, I've read stories about fairs before and even written them as a reporter. News stories, usually with 4-H and cotton candy and rides. But these stories were not about fairs the way people usually talk about them. These stories, they were about the weird and complex ways we actually experience fairs. Welcome to Tales from the Fair, a special edition of The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Jessica Robinson. On this show, we're bringing you those stories commissioned by the Spokesman Review, read here by the authors themselves. You'll meet a solitary man who begrudgingly visits a crowded expo, a private eye who is not what he seems, and you'll learn which ride has the power to ruin your relationship. But first, we find out what happens when a boy confronts one of the truly terrifying moments of childhood, when your family embarrasses you in front of your crush. Here's writer Chris Dennison.
I had used my Expo 74 season pass at least a dozen times before Uncle Fudd and Aunt June came for their annual visit. My sister and I didn't really understand exactly how they were related to us, but they were a fixture in our summertime landscape, as seasonal as the ice cream truck or the August meteor showers. Every July, they drove their camper up from Escondido, California, where Fudd worked as a garbage man. They parked in our side yard under the giant maple tree and stayed for a month. Their visits consisted of June and my mom disappearing into the trailer to can dill pickles and huckleberry jam, while Fudd sat in the shade in his white V-neck t-shirt complaining about the heat. Every so often, he'd yell my name. "Ronnie," he'd shout. "Ronnie, get me a cold Ole and I'll give you a quarter." And I'd do it, partly because I needed all the quarters I could get, and partly because I didn't want Julie Wolfe to hear him yelling. Julie lived behind us, and she was the coolest girl at Glover Middle School for 2 years running, maybe ever. The Expo Pass had been a Christmas present. A bunch of kids got them, but it was also part of my master plan to get Julie's attention. She had one too, and I made it my secret mission to run into Julie at Expo as many times as possible. I'd visited the pavilions, ridden the Jetstar 2, and eaten my weight in Belgian waffles. So far, I'd only netted 6 Julie sightings with 4 actual verbal contacts. During 2 of them, she'd used my name when she'd said hi. Progress for sure. But at that rate, I was going to have to run into her about a zillion times before she realized what I already knew. We were soulmates. 4 days into Fudd and June's visit, I heard Uncle Fudd yelling my name. "I'm bored," he shouted. He was already a couple beers in. "What say you and me head downtown and see about this World's Expo?" I looked at Fudd, trying to decide if he was serious. "What about Aunt June?" But Fudd waved his hand like he was shooing flies. "June will be in there canning for days. Besides, I want to go to the fair with you. You're the resident expert." I glanced back at the camper where Mom and Aunt June had secreted themselves, then at Julie Wolfe's backyard. Julie and her sister had left earlier, and they were probably at Expo. I wanted to see her, but I was pretty sure I didn't want her to meet Uncle Fudd. "I don't know if that's a good idea. Maybe we could go later with Mom?" "What?" Uncle Fudd rose to his feet, swinging his beer back and forth, sloshing drops of it around the lawn. "You some kind of mama's boy?" He elbowed me and winked. "Boys' night out." I followed Fudd to his truck. The minute we stepped through the entrance, Fudd clapped his hands together, looking around. "What's first, my boy? What's a couple of fellas like us gotta see?" I shrugged. "We could go see the giant bugs, or there's a place you can pan for gold." I just wanted to get moving to increase my chances of seeing Julie, but I could see Uncle Fudd wasn't impressed by any of these options. Then he spotted a kid holding a leash leading to an empty dog harness. The leash was stiff with a wire, creating the effect that there was a dog on the leash. "What in the world?" Fudd asked. "Oh, that's an invisible dog." I'd seen the leashes before. "You can get those near the rides." Lead the way, Ronnie. The midway was filled with spinning lights and the herky-jerky motion of carnival rides. Right away, Fudd spotted a booth selling invisible dogs and forked over the cash from a wad in his hip pocket. Now we're cooking with gas, he said, and he was off down the midway. I had to scurry to keep up with him, but it wasn't long before I wish I hadn't. Uncle Fudd was making his invisible dog, who he'd named Zeppo, hump the legs of every good-looking girl he saw. Zeppo, bad dog, he yelled whenever his dog made contact with some girl's bare leg. So sorry, miss. Zeppo just can't resist a pretty girl. I lagged behind Uncle Fudd, keeping contact but also dreading being seen with him. My embarrassment turned to horror as I spotted Julie and her sister coming down the midway on a collision course with Fudd and Zeppo. I froze. I didn't know whether to hide, intercept Julie, or try and divert Fudd down a side aisle. Before I could decide, Julie spotted me. She raised her hand in greeting just as I lunged for Uncle Fudd's invisible dog hand. At that same instant, Zeppo was headed for Julie. All three movements came together in such a way that it appeared I had, in fact, made Zeppo hump Julie's lovely, perfect leg. Julie stared down at the dog, then at Fudd, then at me. Hi, Ronnie. Hey, Julie. I snatched at the leash and wrestled with Uncle Fudd for a minute before letting him have it. It was too late anyway. Why were you trying to steal that old man's invisible dog? Julie asked. Oh, I was in agony. Then Fudd caught my eye, winked, and followed Zeppo down the midway, continuing their reign of terror. I just didn't want his dog to bite you, I said. And then something miraculous happened. Julie Wolfe laughed. And I don't mean at me. She laughed like I'd said something funny. My hero, she said. See you around sometime? I nodded, and Julie and her sister faded into the crowd of fairgoers. I strolled down the midway after Uncle Fudd and his invisible dog.
That was Chris Dennison reading her story titled Uncle Fudd. Chris says she wanted to find a story she could set at Expo 74.
I wasn't here for Expo. But then I remembered the story that my husband had told me about his Uncle Fudd. So this is partly a true story. And his Uncle Fudd actually did this with the invisible dog. He bought an invisible dog and was like peeing on people's legs and humping people's legs at Expo. So, and he actually was a garbage man in Escondido, California. So there were several details in here that I stole from my husband's life, which I often do when I'm writing.
Chris Dennison has a new novel coming out next summer from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. It's called You and Me and Him. Next up, there's a lot lying below the surface of a seemingly lazy Sunday morning. Bruce Hulbert takes us there.
Breakfast. A half dozen scrambled eggs, fried salami, glass of chocolate milk, and one trip to the toilet until his hand steadies. The half-open window bleeds light onto the floor, but the breeze today comes from the mountain, not the city. It smells clean, which provides relief. Today is Labor Day, and Clarence Darrell Culnane has a job on a register at the dollar store, part-time, but with a promise that if he worked out, it would turn more. Outside, the day is pleasantly warm, mitigated by the breeze. Gulls squawk and scoop the pavement and garbage bins for scraps at Dick's, an outdoor hamburger joint. The cityscape pitches with the river valley's topography. Beneath his window, three rap wannabes attempt to rhyme alligator with tomato. But he no longer alternates nights on other sofas. It is his window. The woman who gutted him resides in Tri-Cities with a realtor now. That is not true. He has leaked blood and entrails for as long as he can recall. She just mercifully hosed out the remains. Even in first grade, Clarence longed for a woman to repair him. An odd thought for a 7-year-old. Perhaps it was his nature's feminine elements in search of solidarity or a Freudian hunger for a girl that might finish a boy who already considered himself only half a person. Growing up, he read books and went to school and took drugs only on the weekends, which permitted him nearly the same anonymity as his absence might have. In high school, however, he rolled like a waking sleeper. He learned to laugh easily and was student enough of human nature to apprehend others' vanities and reflect back flattering likenesses. Girls spoke their secrets to him and boys their schemes. It tethered him to others in a way he had not expected possible and required only empathy, which, strangely, he possessed in some quantity. He discovered keeping others amused or even loved was steady work that he was adept at. His girlfriends were fortunate accidents who mistook his obscurity for depth. Each was pretty and interesting. They lied to him when it didn't matter and told the truth when it did. Selfish and generous, miles away and unattainable one moment, then right there talking to him the next. They should have provided him a wonderful education, but even the most attractive people tire of gazing into a mirror. With the most generous and honest of these, Holly, he visited Riverfront Park. The place had been constructed with great local flourish in 1974 to host a World's Fair. Nixon spoke from a dock, and after they released thousands of birds. He and Holly walked the sculpted hills and acres of grass holding hands. She stood on her tiptoes and kissed him under the clock tower when it rang 2 p.m. He had been kissed more passionately, but never more sweetly. From under what was once the American Pavilion, speakers hung on brackets produced carnival music, and children dragged parents by the arm toward the rides and wrestled in line afterwards. He rode the carousel with Holly, where they chose outside horses and hooked the plastic rings with their outstretched hands, which she collected and later sent to him, one at a time, on birthdays or at Christmas, though they quit seeing one another only a month later. That year, Clarence excelled in sports enough to make the paper occasionally. His graduating class voted him president and best personality. But his successes faded in and out like a distant radio station, while his failures produced a perfect signal. The latter appeared to him the impermanence of good fortune, the former disappointment's certainty. He felt he had traveled his path as far as he could without repeating the circle, which he did not care to do. So, one night, he devised a novel and cowardly plan for suicide. He would remain living and oppose every instinct he possessed. Freshman year of college, he wagered and lost his financial aid check in a poker game. His grades left him on academic probation. That summer, he slept in automobiles or parks when the weather was amenable. With a vagrant, he drugged a guard dog, then heisted a pound of marijuana still on the vine. Too green to sell, it was sufficient to swap for meals and cheap beer and to keep him hazily disconnected from his poor prospects in the summer heat. It seems to him a direct line from there to sitting on a windowsill in a building that catered to the indigent. His apartment is nearly a mile from the park, but the wind and air and the hush of a Sunday morning deliver him the carousel's song and the gaggle of children. It is impossible, he decides. Then he recognizes a block away the ice cream truck, a scratchy jingle playing through its bullhorn, four children behind waving dollar bills. He doesn't believe in signs, though he would like to. A half inch of whiskey remains in the bottle on the table, usually cause for him to mourn or compose a plan. But Clarence pours the last out his window. It splatters on the pavement below and pocks the white boys. "Hey!" one shouts. They look at Clarence. "Get thee to a nunnery," Clarence tells them. Across the street, a lark whistles. He can feel it. His life has changed.
That was Bruce Hulbert reading a story called Sunday Morning. This story has a tagline. It goes, "With apologies to Raymond Carver." Bruce says that's because Carver's story, Fat, ends with the line, "My life is going to change. I feel it."
I love that last line, and it keeps trying to sneak into things. And I finally said, well, I suppose it's okay to borrow it as long as I acknowledge where it came from.
Bruce Hulbert's new novel is The Hour of Lead. It's published by Counterpoint Press. Our next author is Sharma Shields, and she found inspiration for her story from an old photograph. It was a picture of a family traveling by train to Spokane's Expo 74 from Seattle.
An older daughter, a younger son, and then the mom and dad. And the daughter was looking out the window, and looked like she was kind of ruminating over something. And I just started writing the story based on that.
And without spoiling anything, let me just say, wait till you hear where Sharma took it.
This is all about the environment, kids, Mom tells Ernie and me. She opens an arm up toward the river, which is slow-moving, wide and clean. It's all about how man and nature can live in harmony. She's been repeating some version of this since we arrived, and Ernie's stopped listening. He's peering at the map, trying to find the A&W. No more international food, he mutters. A hamburger, a root beer float, no more rice. Dad waggles his beer and ogles the fairgoers. A group of young women gather on the platform. They wear miniskirts and boots and tight blouses. Their perfume rolls lightly over us, patchouli and jasmine. Dad smirks at them for a moment and then drops his head back and drains half the can. President Nixon stood right here on this platform, kids, Mom says. Right here. I'll bet he gave the most moving speech about the environment. I can almost feel his words in my toes, can't you? Dad finishes his beer, belches, pitches the empty can into the river. It lands with a flat splash. The current pushes it lazily westward. Aw, Dad, Ernie says. I could have fed that to the garbage goat. Mom reddens. Her mouth works as though something is alive inside of it. Something that wants to get out. What's that, hun? Dad says. I've watched my mom do this a million times, so it comes as no surprise when she swallows her rage. It's a literal physical swallowing. Her cheeks balloon with backdraft, her eyes bulge, her nostrils flare, and then her whole face closes down and she gulps. You stand there expecting her to scream from the pain and effort, but she chokes it all down. The next moment she's bright, smiling, staring at us with the same irritating amount of affection. So, she says, who wants ice cream? It was Mom's idea, of course, to take the train from Seattle to Spokane for the World's Fair. Dad said Expo was a waste of money, but then Mom and I caught him nuzzling his secretary's neck at the annual St. Patrick's Day office party. Amanda, the secretary, was dressed as a green elf with pointy fake ears. Mom said nothing on the drive home from the party. Our car felt held together by the pins of her silence. If she uttered even a syllable, we'd fly apart in an explosion of gears and wheels and metal panels. I held my breath for entire neighborhoods, begging her to stay quiet. She did. For the next few weeks, Mom got what she wanted. Bouquets of roses, lavish dinner dates, tickets to Expo. Ernie wondered about the change in our summer plans, but I guarded their secret from him, feeling nuanced and proud. I was an adult now. Life is complicated, I'd tell Ernie, and he'd roll his eyes at me and groan. It wasn't like I took pleasure in my parents' unhappiness, but I did relish the maturity it forced me to bear. After lunch, Mom shepherds us under the sprawling white pavilion so that we can see our first IMAX film. The Grand Canyon, Mom gushes. It's going to be like we're there, kids. It's like two vacations in one. The usher hands us barf bags in case we experience motion sickness. Far out, Ernie says. I want to see a guy puke. In the theater, the movie screen is wide and high. A blank ivory sheet. This is really cool, Mom, I say, but she's not listening to me. She's listening to Dad, who's telling Ernie about hypocrisy. I mean, that's how the world is, Ernie, Dad says. People say one thing, but do another. Take the theme for this fair, the environment, right? I mean, who are they kidding? Did you see the sponsors? Exxon, General Motors, Ford, for Christ's sakes. The environment. What a sham. Mom sputters about it not being so simple. Not really. But Dad speaks over her. It's simple in the sense that they're a bunch of liars, right down to their bones. Mom stands up then, clutching her barf bag. She excuses herself and shoves past the knees in our aisle. I give Dad a withering look. What? He says. What did I say? I rise. The room darkens. The screen flickers to life. Dad grips my hand for a moment, but I keep going. I find Mom outside of the theater, looking pale in the grass. She holds the barf bag open under her mouth. My first thought is that she's about to be sick. Mom, I say, I want to say I'm sorry, but that would suggest how wrong things are. Mom, I'm glad we're here. Her eyes soften. She withdraws the bag and opens her mouth to speak, but what exits from her are not words, but two clamped red fists. Something, someone, is crawling out of her throat. He emerges, arms first, then head. It's a little clay man, formed from the magma of her insides, his shoulders streaming with smoke. Mom reaches up, eyes bulging, and offers the clay man a finger to grasp. He uses it to climb out of her mouth, down her chest, over to the ground. His feet burn two crooked ovals in the grass. Mommy, I say, although I haven't called her that in years. Oh, Karen, I tried so hard, Mom says hoarsely. I tried to protect you for as long as I could. You're too young for this. I'm not too young. I'm practically a woman now, but I'm shell-shocked, speechless, and I wish the little man would throw himself into the river, tunnel into the ground, anything, just so long as he disappears. Instead, he stands regarding me with his small fists on his hips. Mom, I say, what's it doing? Mom crawls toward me and presses her palms against either side of my jaw. She works my mouth open. The little man steps into my lap. It was like this for me too, Mom says. Relax, Karen. Stop fighting. It's better if you don't fight. I try to pull away, but her grip is too firm on my face, and the little man is too quick, crawling up and in, filling my mouth, then my throat and chest, pressing my organs aside to make room. Mom rocks back on her heels, crying. I'm burned up, inside and out. Let it be, she says, and I swallow like it's my choice.
Sharma Shields, reading a story called Harmony. Sharma says she knew from the start that the mother's rage was going to be an actual little man, but what that little man did once he emerged, that came later after running the story by her writers group.
I think originally I had the little man, he was tunneling his way into the earth at the end of the story. He had come out of the woman's mouth, but it was so much better that she turns around and feeds it to her daughter. It's just so scary and is kind of this great metaphor for how sometimes we do have to swallow, you know, what the adults are kind of feeding us, and that's what the girl does there, and there's a sort of coming of age, disturbing quality to that, I think.
Sharma Shields has a collection of short stories called Favorite Monster. Her debut novel comes out from Henry Holt in January. It's called The Sasquatch Hunter's Almanac. Our final story today comes from Jill Malone, and this story is also inspired by a photograph from Expo 74. Only Jill knows the story behind the photograph because it was a photo of her own family. Here's Jill.
My mother first visited Spokane to see Expo 74 and to meet my father's extended family. I hitched a ride as a fetus and only know these stories secondhand. The Soviet pavilion, President Nixon at the opening ceremony, my legendary Aunt Lucy, nearly undone by cancer, struggling to navigate the crowds at the first environmentally themed World's Fair. We were the little city that could, although not mine yet. Spokane would come later, after 20 years of military life, traveling to other cities with other fairs. When we lived abroad, fairs were the way I remembered America, the corn dog, the caramel apple, the loping pony rides. Cowboys with hats tilted back, wisps of cotton candy, the hawkers, as they called you, to adventure. It was already there, this love for the muddy walkways and the vendors' windows. I grew up on manicured army bases and felt only delight for that moment I got to feel the scruffy backs of goats, to feed them from the cup of my palm. Books had taught me to keep a lookout for a greedy rat hunting wrappers with words printed on them, or the delicate script of a spider's web advertising some pig. I can see them, my father's family, introducing my mother to Spokane, to the shiny version of Expo 74, with the classic clock tower and opera house, the river sneaking through, the IMAX screen promising a future of natural and technical wonders. Spokane, we might be anything, a city of tomorrow, to enter by the carousel and the marvelous suction goat and wander into the park along the pathways to the falls, the mesmerizing city of trains. I'd have leaned against my Aunt Lucy's hip and posed there on the bridge. She was the kind of woman gangsters in old movies refer to as a dame, a hard-drinking, hard-smoking, bright, curvy woman with a wit so quick it had dashed around you twice before you'd noticed. I think of Expo 74 as hers and mine, one of us leaving and the other on her way. Nobody wants to think about that part, how temporary the fair is, the boom and bust of summer, how we gather with our neighbors and family to hear a series of bands play while the bees alight on ears of corn and sticky smears of barbecue. Fairs are my favorite outdoor markets, as reliable as my childhood. Glasses of lemonade in their hands, my mother and my aunt raise their drinks to the camera. The photograph catches the light failing around them, the tiredness in her shoulders, how close I am to appearing. Expo 74, the last photographs anyone has of her. I wish I could tell Aunt Lucy about the first time I took my son to the county fair. I offered to buy him some elephant ears, and he stopped, heartstruck, and yelled up at the vendor, "You can't eat those! They need them! Those poor elephants!"
That's Jill Malone reading a story called Our Expo 74. That World's Fair changed the face of Spokane. A lot of today's landmarks in the city date back to that fair. Jill says it was also the last time anyone has a photo of her great aunt Lucy.
And so for me, the prompt was that she was this wild, dangerous woman at this moment when Spokane was really trying to be something brand new, you know, something that it still, I think, is struggling to be, a city that is not like Seattle and not second to Seattle, you know, but a real city in its own right. And I like that. I like that idea of how cool Spokane was in that weird, awkward moment. And that she was like that too, that she was a weird, awkward woman.
Jill Malone is the author of Red Audrey and the Roping and A Field Guide to Deception, which won the Lambda Literary Award. Her most recent novel is called Giraffe People. Tales from the Fair is a production of Spokane Public Radio. These stories originally appeared in the Spokesman Review and were edited by Carolyn Lamberson. I'm Jessica Robinson. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next time with more stories from Polly Buckingham, Shan Ray, Nance Van Winkle, and Jess Walter.
"My friends warned me about her," I said. "But when a woman says I love you, how are you supposed to know it's a lie?" "It's always a lie," said Argyle Borfus.